Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong profitable impact on your business.
Good morning, everyone. I just lost one of my monitors. How embarrassing is that? It's got all of my notes on it so that I can introduce Randy, and I have no idea what just happened. Do you ever have those days where just nothing wants to work properly for you? I'm having one of those days. So hang on just a second while I find my notes, because they're great. They're great notes. I just need to be able to open them. So hang on just a second here. So anyway, today I am very much looking forward to talking with Randy Pennington. And I feel like an idiot. Randy, I am so sorry.
That's okay.
Do you...
I don't want you to feel like an idiot. Technology conspires against us some days.
Well, I've got three monitors, and the one that I have my notes on just went, nah, I think I'm tired, I'm going to take a break, and that's just all there is to it. And I cannot seem to open it up in the window that I want it to open up in, so hold on just a second. In the meantime, while I am struggling to find my notes, would you kind of like to jump in and introduce
yourself? Sure. Why don't I introduce myself then?
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, I'm Randy.
And, you can take over the show, and I will sit here and beat my monitor to death.
tell me when you want to jump back in, but I'm Randy Pennington, and I'm an author and a consultant and sort of a business strategist. And what I do is I work with leaders and companies who understand where they want to go, but they need to make changes either from a strategy standpoint or in some cases actually change their organizations to be able to get from where they are to where they want to be. And if you saw my photo, you would see a lot of gray hair, and you know that I've been doing this a while. The gray hair is all real. It's not painted in for effect or anything.
Oh.
But I work with companies as small as probably, 10 or 15 or 20 to as large as the Fortune 10. And my client base runs across all kinds of different organizations in different industries. So I spend most of my time. I had a repairman at my house yesterday working on some things, my sprinkler system in my yard. And he said, "What do you do exactly?" And he said, "I think I attend meetings for a living." So
I know. I've been there, done that. And I had a kind of a similar thing the other day where. I think people don't understand when you work from home. They really don't. Have you ever had this people say, "Well, you're not busy. I'm coming by." No, you're not. No,
right.
No. Don't come by. I'm really busy.
Well, and any time, yeah, you're right. Any time that you work from home, we've been very fortunate that several years ago I actually built about 900 square feet of dedicated office space on the second floor of my house. And
nice.
Yeah, so I mean, we have everything that we need, including the corporate health club, as we call it, which is my exercise room. And
mine's in the garage.
Yeah. So we have that. But people around the neighborhood know that during the day, if you want us to answer the door, you probably should call first because we just don't answer, and that's just the way it works.
Right.
But so yeah, there's good news and bad news about having that office, or as we like to call it, the intergalactic headquarters. That is an easy commute away.
It's never been
a problem for us.
No, me either. My commute is about 3.5 minutes, and that's just to take time out to trip over a cat.
Right.
And stop and kind of visit the rest of the house and go, ooh, pretty, and then get into my office. So I just got my monitor back. How do you like that?
Great.
But you are a nicer, kinder person than I am, because I actually have a sign on, I have glass panes in my door, And I actually have a sign that says, if I am not expecting you or you weren't invited, please do not knock or ring the doorbell. And, you know, it works wonders with politicians and small children trying to sell me gift wrap. But, you know, other people just stand there and look at it and go, ooh, I wonder if she has a gun in there. So who knows? But you have to create those boundaries when you work from home.
Well, I mean, it's not unlike any business, though. I mean, if you're an entrepreneur or if you're in business today, one of the big challenges that everybody faces is creating boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we teach others how we want to be treated.
Definitely.
And whether that's our customers, you know, we teach our customers how to work with us. And we teach our coworkers how to work with us. We even teach our boss how to work with us sometimes.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, I haven't been in somebody else's workplace in a long time. Excuse me. But I remember having to figure out where their boundaries were and really set my own and enforce them, you know, so you don't just get plowed over. Do the best work you can do. Do everything you can do to be a resource, but don't get underfoot, I think.
Right. That's a big part of it. I had someone contact me from my social media list a few weeks back, having problems with their boss, and you know, their boss was being very abusive. And I wrote back and said, you know, are they being abusive to you? And he says, oh no, I set very clear boundaries. They're not abusive to me at all. But I you know, I wonder what I can do about the other people's boundaries, and because I see those being violated all the time. And I said, well, it's hard to get people to stand up for themselves, but that's eventually what they'll have to do. So,
yeah, and I'm not sure that it's their place to do that, is it?
Well,
I mean, they can make suggestions, I would think, but other than that, that's about all you can do.
Yes, it's their place if what you're seeing is illegal,
right?
You know, blatantly unethical or immoral. If it's, you know, those types of things. We all have a responsibility in that regard. But if it's, you know, you allow yourself to be, you know, you're not just setting boundaries, you're right. You can be supportive of your colleague, but they have to stand up for themselves. I mean, there's a very fine line. It's ultimately, I think we all are responsible for the success of our organizations. And so, you know, if you're seeing something that is illegal, if you're seeing something that's unethical, if it's a theft, if it's a blatant, something blatant like that, or, you know, sexual harassment or something, you know, you have a responsibility to stand up, even to speak up, even if that other individual doesn't.
Right. Well, I certainly understand that.
Right.
Okay. You know what I wanted to talk with you about today, and I didn't get a chance to really kind of go through all of your credentials, and you touched on them a little bit. So I would really encourage people to go find you on the internet at thepenningtongroup.com. But what I want our audience to know before we get really deep into this, because I have a ton of questions for you, is that Randy is the author of three books, Results Rule, On My Honor, I Will, and most recently, and this is the one I wanted to talk about today a bit, Make Change Work. So, and you've been all over the place. I mean, your expertise has made you show up in places like CNN, PBS, Fox News, the ABC Radio Network, and my favorite, the BBC. And your views have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Entrepreneur, that's the magazine, right? Entrepreneur magazine, Executive Excellence, Training and Development in numerous newspapers and many professional trade association journals. All that is to say, you know what you're talking about. That's what I'm saying.
Well, you know, or at least I talk a lot about it. One of the two.
Whatever works. But I really wanted to chat with you about your newest book, because there are a lot of changes going on in government and how people perceive our economy, how people perceive business, how people perceive entrepreneurism. And I really wanted to kind of get your take on what people can do. First of all, the challenges that they're facing and what they can do.
Well, I mean, let's talk about the challenges. What I want to share, Denise, is what I've decided may be the one single question that helps people figure out how well you're going to do. But the challenges are very real. Interestingly enough, everybody points to the economic meltdown of 2008 is sort of the turning point. But the fact is, every change that we are experiencing, every disruptive thing has happened at some level in some way before. So, for example, the economic meltdown of 2008, if you go back in history, it shares a strikingly eerie resemblance to the Dutch tulip bubble of the Dutch tulip crisis of 1637.
Hang on a second. I know a little bit about that. Go tell the story, because I read something about that not too long ago, and it's interesting that you should bring that up.
Well,
so
for example,
can you tell people what that was?
Yeah, the Dutch tulip bubble. Tulips were the speculative currency of the time, and much like housing laws, remember when everybody was, you know, you buy a house and you keep it and you flip it and you do that. So housing became very much a speculative currency, and it was fine as long as everybody was making their mortgage payments. Well, in the Dutch tulip crisis, what happened is everybody assumed that tulips were a currency that would continue to escalate, and then one day somebody didn't show up to pay for their tulips.
Mm.
And then all of a sudden, what happened from that is everybody thought, oh my gosh, the bottom has fallen out, and it sent the entire economy into a depression that lasted for years. And so, I mean, the point of that story is there's always been speculative bubbles out there. There have always been technology changes that cause us to do things differently. You go back as children, remember the story about John Henry, the steel driving man that was competing to, you know, to lay railroad tracks against the
right.
Yeah, the steam. Yeah, but, well, he was competing against technology. There's always been trade and imports and exports dating back to Marco Polo. I mean, yeah, so there's always been those things that have been out there, and they always affect us. And one of the challenges, though, that makes it happen today is, that makes today a little bit different, is that things are happening exponentially faster. And that's because
they are.
Of technology, that's because of a global presence, that's because the barriers have been removed from that. I mean, the person who you're competing against right now, if you're in business today, if you have a product right now, there's probably somebody in their garage that's going to be your competitor in the next 3 years that you don't even know about right now. Or there's a new technology that you haven't even thought about, or there's new developments that are going on. So from the standpoint of surviving today in this world, and we talk about it being in a world of constant change, then the only way that you can do that is that you have to stay nimble. You have to figure out how to run further and faster than you've ever run before, while simultaneously you're already running as far and fast as you can.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it does,
I mean,
feel
that,
like that. It really does.
Yeah, and so here's what I've decided with that, that the ultimate question for us today really comes down to a very simple one. Are you a dodo bird or a coyote?
And I know that's on, it's in your book, The Dodo Bird.
The dodo bird is on,
isn't
the
it
cover.
On your cover? Yeah.
It's on the cover of the Make Change workbook. There's the upside
right.
down dodo, which sort of signifies that the dodo is dead. And the reason that showed up is my editor at Wiley's, wonderful team there. They came up with this idea and they wanted to put the dodo on the cover. And I said, well, but you know, there's really, we got to find that, we got to give something different than that. And so the dodo bird is sort of the classic for extinction, because they became extinct within 100 years of their first human contact. They were totally gone. Now, at the same time,
they probably got eaten.
Well, interestingly enough, dodos couldn't fly. They were, you know, the sailors inhabited them. They were very curious. They didn't get eaten per se, although sailors did eat them from time to time. Their meat was kind of tough, but they laid their eggs on the ground.
Oh.
And so all the dogs and cats and pigs and
right.
everything else that
domestic
came off
animals that humans brought, yeah.
Yeah, and so it was really that sort of secondary consequence that did them in. And, you know, here's the thing. The dodos were perfectly situated to thrive in a world that no longer existed.
Mm.
And you know, it really wasn't their fault. I mean, they're not. I mean, they're animals. They're birds. Their brains aren't that big enough to reason. You know, but a lot of times as humans, we find ourselves perfectly situated to thrive in a world that no longer exists. And that, and when we allow ourselves to do that, the world's going to continue without us. It's our responsibility to figure out how to thrive. And so the model from the positive side of that, I think, is the coyote, or the coyote, depending on which part of the world you live in. And
coyote
from,
down
yeah,
there.
Yeah, so,
and they chatter at night. When they start chattering, I'm looking for the dog. Where are you?
Yeah, so where do you live? Where, you're in?
Louisiana.
Okay, you're in Louisiana. So so they do, but, I mean, let's go back and understand that animal. Their natural habitat was originally the desert southwest of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Now they exist literally from coast to coast, as far south as Central America and as far north as Alaska. Researchers have speculated that up to 2,000 of them may be living in urban Chicago, for example.
And they're taxi drivers.
Yeah, it's true. And
they could be.
They could be, but they are. Nobody had to send them to a training class that says, "Okay, be nimble and adaptable." They just figure out a way to adapt. It's in their DNA, and you know they're speedy. They're nimble. They've learned to hide in plain sight. You hear the chances are in Louisiana, you hear them only when they want you to hear them, because more likely they are hiding in plain sight during the day and you never notice them.
You know, you don't hear them often, but when you do, you know that somebody just lost a pet.
Yes, yeah, and I mean they can be the bane. I mean they're the bane of existence for pet owners and for ranchers and for whatever, but you have to respect that as a species, they are extremely adaptable, and they constantly...
Well, hunger is a great motivator.
Well, hunger is a great motivator, and so if you're an entrepreneur, the question is, you know, what are you hungry for?
Exactly, and that was my point. Yeah, I am not one, I'm a fiscal conservative, and I'll just say it straight out, I am not one for government programs of any description. My thinking is that you can do it on your own if you just recognize the need to do so. And like you say, if you're hungry enough.
Well, and, you know, I go back to my upbringing. I grew up in northeast Texas in a small community. My uncle was a minister of a church in an even smaller community than the one that I lived in. The church provided him a house and paid his utilities and gave him a small car allowance. That's it. He spent his entire career raising two sons and sending them to college, knowing that his salary was based upon what people gave in the offering plate during each service. Mm-hmm. And I asked him one time, I said, because, you know, you're beloved in this community. If you ask for a salary, they would give you one. And he said, you know, Randy, it's something I learned a long time ago, that a hungry dog hunts better.
Mm-hmm.
And so saying exactly the same thing that you're saying, is that, you know, when people become hungry, and so the question then for us as a society, for communities, for individuals, is, you know, what is it that we're hungry for? People will become very creative when they have a clear, compelling goal. For example, imagine that you are the parent of a three-year-old, and your three-year-old walks in and sees the ultimate prize on the top of your refrigerator. It's a jar of double-stuffed Oreo cookies. Now, what will a three-year-old do to bridge that gap between their current reality of not being able to reach the top of the refrigerator and getting those cookies?
I have no idea. I've seen them climb cabinets.
Yeah, the short answer for the sake of time is probably everything, right?
Everything.
Yeah.
Whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes. You don't have to tell them to think outside the box. You don't have to tell them be creative. You don't have to tell them.
Yeah.
You don't have to tell them any of that. You know, it's time for you to go to a training program. All you have to do is point to the cookies. Now,
well, kids don't really understand no, so their mind, you know, is nimble. I'm using your word.
Right.
I remember this as a child. If I was faced with a problem, instantly I came up with three solutions. And I just kept going down those solutions until one of them worked. And to be honest, I still do that.
Well, that's what here's the question, though. You only do that, do you do that in any problem, or do you only do that in problems that are important to you?
You know, I would like to answer that, but I can't, because I'm going to have to think about it.
Yeah, so for example, parents always tell me that kids will go after double stuffed Oreos in a heartbeat. And then I ask the question, do you have that same problem if there's Brussels sprouts on top of the refrigerator?
Yeah.
And invariably the answer is no.
Right.
You know. So my question then for when I work with companies that want to engage their people to change more and to be more nimble and to be more adaptive, and it's the same as individuals who say, you know, I'm really struggling with how do I stay motivated to continue to grow? It really comes down to what's on top of your refrigerator.
Well, how do people, Randy, when they come to you, I mean, clearly they've identified a problem. And this is an oddball question, I admit it, but do you find that as people get older, it becomes more and more difficult for them to kind of step out of their own paradigms and identify these problems, that the problem is probably actually within them, or the resistance is within them, or are you finding, it's a two-part question, I guess, or are you finding that given the way things are going in the world right now, that people are saying, you know what, I don't need to stand around and get hit by that steamroller. Let me find a solution.
I think it's two things. I think it's not as much age-related as it is comfort-related.
Okay, maybe that was my real question. Okay,
and
keep
on
going.
Yeah, and so from the standpoint of comfort, once we become comfortable in a situation, then the answer is we become more resistant to change, because change by nature takes us out of our habits.
Mm-hmm.
And it disrupts our expectations. I mean, managing and change in our organization or in our life is really about helping people manage their disrupted expectations. And so if you, from a comfort standpoint, think this is the way it's always been, if you are the dodo who is extremely comfortable in its environment, then you see no need to change. So it really comes down to comfort. I've seen 80-year-olds who are still extremely curious and vibrant, and I've seen 20-year-olds
mm-hmm.
who, you know, stop changing at 15. So, and so it really comes down to comfort level. And then there's a second piece, to go back to your second part of the question, Denise. People are dissatisfied, and when they don't see a way out, then they are more likely to give up. And I think that goes back to your concerns mm-hmm. about the economy, about the government, about all those things. When people don't feel like there is a way out, when they've lost hope, if you will.
Yeah.
They're more likely to give up.
And I have to say, I'm seeing it from both sides. I'm seeing people saying, I'm just overwhelmed. And I'm sensing kind of a low-level sense of dread from a lot of people, just for so many reasons. And one of the first things I'll tell them is turn off the news. Make your own economy. Turn the news off, seriously. Unless it is in your house directly impacting you, let it go. Do what you need to do to take care of you and your family. And I don't know if that's good advice or not, but it works for me.
Well, and it's certainly, I mean, I think you have to be very selective about what you hear. And you have
mm-hmm.
to, you know, I'm a real fan. I'm like you. I tend to go more toward the physically conservative standpoint. But
yeah.
I make sure that I watch other points of view.
Oh, yeah, I want to know what's going on, but I don't listen to it and go, oh, gosh, oh, gosh, oh, gosh. You know, I just don't. My brain doesn't work that way.
But I mean, I think there's a value for, so for example, if you believe that, you know, if you prefer to get your news from Fox News, then periodically you need to watch MSNBC. even though it's going to make you nuts when you do that.
I just gagged a little bit, I have to say.
Yeah, I mean, you need to watch
Chris
it.
Matthews, no, I'm not
but
doing it.
Because you have to understand, again, that's part of that staying nimble is being able to embrace the idea that, you know, I may not believe this, but it sharpens you. And you may not agree with it, but the more important thing is for you to know why you don't agree with it.
Educate yourself.
And you have to educate yourself so that you can understand why you believe what you do. And and I think that's a big part of staying nimble. It's a big part of staying relevant. And, you know, and it's a big part of being able to be adaptable in a world that's constantly changing.
Right, and it is constantly changing. I'll be honest with you, I watch very little news these days, but I'm a voracious reader, and I get all of my news online, and that way I'm able to, I can read it and absorb it much better than if I have some talking head, you know, telling me what to think. So I just learn differently by reading than hearing.
Well, and I think that's, I would love to see people read more. I mean, we now live in a world where a 90-second piece is now called an in-depth analysis.
I know.
And that is the challenge. I mean, it's the challenge of speed, but it's also the challenge of when you get all your information, either about your business or your life or your government or your economy or whatever, when you get it all
in
90-second chunks. Yeah, when you get it all in 90-second chunks, then you don't have the chance to engage in a critical thinking. And, you know,
I agree.
And again, the critical thinking piece of it is what allows you to make better choices.
Well, it allows you to make those better choices, those better purchasing decisions, you know, those better hiring decisions. You know, I think if people would just stand back a little bit and stop and breathe and just take time to really examine what's going on, they could make better decisions.
Well, and, you know, I wrote about this in the Make Change workbook, that you would think that people, when presented with informed decisions, would make different choices, but they don't always do that. The example that I used was the last, so I guess it was 2012, when we had the last general election, when all the seats in the U.S. House of Representatives were up for re-election, at a time when when the U.S. Congress had its approval level was at probably historic lows, you know, 16, 17, 18%, whatever that was.
Right. I thought it was 14, but it may be higher.
Yeah, so whatever that was, but it was extremely low. I mean, basically you had 85, 90% of the people thought these people aren't doing a good job, and yet we reelected 94, 95% of the incumbents were reelected.
Yeah, I didn't understand that at all.
So, in other words, what we're really saying is that when we, you know, part of it, we get the leadership from a government standpoint that we deserve because we put them in there. But the other part is when you're understanding about your life, I don't want to go, you know, delve into Ayn Rand for a second, but there is a little bit about you have to take responsibility and be a little selfish about the results that you want. And, you know, that's part of being, going back to this idea of overwhelmed standpoint, you know, I found it very interesting in the Steve Jobs biography that was written. One of the things that Jobs, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, that Jobs said he was most proud of at Apple were the things they decided not to do.
You know, I remember that, but I can't recall what he said that they decided not to do.
Well, I mean, there's some products they decided not to do. I mean, you probably never heard of those products they decided not to do. But there were products.
So just because you have an idea doesn't mean you have to act on it.
Just because you have an idea. And so if you take that and extend it into how do you make sense of this world that everything is coming at you and you feel bombarded, you know, there's some things that you just have to say, and if it's the news, great. If it's the news, if it's, you know, understand what are those things that are really important. And then if it's not important, and your calendar, by the way, is your checkbook tells you what's important for your purchasing, your calendar tells you what's important for your time. And if you really want to know how you're spending your time, look at your calendar. If you really want to know why things aren't happening that are important, look at your calendar. And when I coach leaders, one of the things, and invariably a leader will tell me, I don't have time to think about the future. I don't have time to be proactive. I don't have time to do anything except run to keep up. And so I always ask, show me what's on your calendar. Show me how you're spending your time. And almost 100% of the time, there's always things on their calendar that other people either could be doing or should be doing, but that leader doesn't want to let it go.
And that's a big problem. I'm guilty of that myself. I have a fairly large team, you know, virtual assistants and online. I'm an online business manager and a web developer, and I have a great team. And I catch myself going, it's just quicker to do it myself. And then I just go, oh, Denise, really? And I do the head smack, you know, like, shame on
right.
you.
And I do as well. I mean, and my team has figured out that there are some things that I probably shouldn't be doing, mm-hmm. but I like to do them, and they figured out how to compensate for that. But at least I was honest with them and saying, you know what, I like doing this.
Right.
And until I decide not to do it, I want to keep doing it because I enjoy doing it. Now, that's easy for me. I mean, I don't do it on everything, but I have one or two things. If you go on, for example, our YouTube channel, you see that there's we have a lot of video up out there. I like editing video.
Really?
It's creative for me. I edit my own video.
Nice.
And so, you know, and I've got, this honking big computer with multiple monitors and all that, and all kinds of edit stuff and what. And, you know, I don't do a lot of editing, but I enjoy doing it. And so I could farm that out. That is something that by rights ought to go to somebody else. But I like doing it. It's creative for me. It gives me an opportunity to kind of be a little creative and do something a little different and jog my. So I do it. And I have to make time for it because I can't let other things slide because I like to do it, which means there's other things that I have to say no to. And I think if you're an entrepreneur in business today, you have to figure out what are those things that you're good at, what are those things that you need other people to be good at, and how do you then divide it up? And as long as you're clear about it and you make good choices about your partners that you bring in, mm-hmm. you can figure out a way to get that done.
You know, Randy, you're absolutely right. One of the things that I hear, particularly in my industry, you know, I have a very active Facebook group for virtual assistants, and so many of them want to grow their team. Many of them are solopreneurs. And so many, and this is kind of a constant question, and I'll be honest with you, I'm never real sure how to answer it, so you maybe can help. But the question is, look, I need to bring on team members, but I can't afford to pay anybody. And I'm never sure, because without going into their business model, I really don't know what they're doing, so I can't just kind of issue a blanket statement and go, we'll do this. But would you have any words of advice for somebody who really does need to outsource some of the minor things that they're doing to somebody on a team member? I mean, what would you tell them? I think it's a mindset thing, to be honest.
Part of it is a mindset. Part of it is a how you do it. I mean, you can, in other words, is this something that you are outsourcing that could be outsourced? You know, you don't need a full-time employee, maybe. You could do it on a contract basis. So you could do it from a contract standpoint. You could find other ways of doing it. You could find the college student who needs, you know, we just outsourced a project to a recent college graduate who I knew hadn't found a job yet. And, I said, you know, here's what I've got, and I can pay you X, which was probably less than she should work with a college degree. But you know what? She was happy to do it because she could do it in the evenings when she was sitting at home on her computer in another city.
Right.
And it's something that I was able to do very economically. Here's the question I always ask when people start asking, you know, wanting to bring people on board or outsource things. Are you doing it because you don't have time to do everything that you need to do? And if you didn't do this, I mean, if you outsourced it, what would that free you up to do that's going to generate more value and more revenue for you? Because
good point.
I mean, there's got to be, you know, in my days as a consultant, years ago I was a partner in a consulting firm. The model that we used is that for every dollar that I had for that I paid a consultant out there with a client, I needed to get $3 worth of revenue back. And so I needed to figure out, first off, what was that ramp-up time? And, you know, the other part from that I would look at, when is it time to bring on a new person? It's time to bring on a new person when the fact that you're doing this is costing you money.
Right. When let's just say your hourly fee is $95 an hour, and you're doing something that you should be paying somebody $15 or $20 an hour.
Right, and you're turning down $95 an hour business because you're paying somebody $15 because you're doing $15 an hour.
That's right, and you can't. You have no more hours in the day.
Right, and so the trap that I think a lot of solopreneurs get into, and I find myself into it as well, is to say, well, I'll just work longer.
I do that. It wears you out. It's not smart. It wears you out.
And in a long-term strategy, it's, I mean, short-term, we all do whatever we need to do to get the job done. Long-term, it destroys your health. It destroys your relationships. It makes you a really boring person to be around.
Well, you were saying that I have this vision of my head of me standing in front of a group of people that are sitting on folding chairs. And I'm bowing my head and saying, my name is Denise Griffiths, and I'm a workaholic.
Well, and see, solopreneurs...
I mean, I need a 12-step program.
Well, the solopreneur, I mean, it's very easy. And I, like I said, I have an office. It's on the second floor of my house. It's very easy if I don't like what's on television or if I don't have anything to read or if I don't have anything to do. I'll say, okay, well, I'll come up and check email before I go to bed. 3 hours later...
Yep.
You know,
it's 1 o'clock in the morning.
It's 1 o'clock in the morning,
right?
And I've got to get up for I've got to be at a meeting at 7:30, and it's so you do have to watch yourself as a solopreneur. I think you have to watch yourself even, or as an entrepreneur, you have to watch yourself even more than you do when you work for a company, because with companies, that sooner or later they tell you to go home,
right?
When you look around the office or you look around the place where you work and you're the only person there, you know, you
start
to get
a life,
it out.
Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I mean, at some point you have to make the choice. And I'll share a personal story because this may be helpful for your listeners. Years ago.
You mean for me, right?
Well.
That's very kind of you, but it's really for me, I know.
You know, years ago. And I'll tell you, this was my first marriage. Okay, so that tells you something right there. But so it's many, many years ago. I was working for an organization. I was in a startup, and I was working about 60 hours a week. And I came home one night, and my then wife was pulling some food out of the oven that she'd been trying to keep warm. And she said, you know, I need to tell you that I owe you an apology. And I said, well, okay, why? And she goes, because I've been mad at you. I've been mad at your boss. I've been mad at the people that you work with, and I owe you an apology because that's affected thing. And I said, okay. And she said, because it really bugged me that you're working 60 hours a week, you know, all the time, and your boss doesn't work that much. And then then the people that report to you, I was a senior executive in this organization, the people that report to you, they don't work that much. And I felt it was extreme, you know, and I felt really bad that it was unfair that, you know, your boss and all the people that reported to you didn't have enough on their plate and that you were being forced to do their job. And then I finally came to me that the issue isn't that they have more, that you have more to do than them. The issue is you're just not as good at your job as they are, and it takes you longer.
Ouch.
And so I want you to know that I apologize for feeling that way, and whatever you need to do to feel like you can catch up and stay where you need to be, I understand.
Was she from the Deep South? That was a very Deep South kind of a speech.
It was.
That was controlled invective. It was beautiful.
But she was right. And I made a point at that time. I was in a hospital, and I said, you know, if I'm on call, then I obviously have to respond. If I have a meeting that with the second shift or the night shift, obviously I have to be there. But other than those situations, I would be out the door and in my car by 5:30 every afternoon. And I did.
How long did that take you to get comfortable with that?
Because
that's changed.
Weeks.
I mean, that's
a big
changed.
Change. You know, yeah. And everybody thinks it takes 21 to 30 days to make a new change. That's not true.
I know it's not.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it, how long it takes to develop, it depends on the habit. When I read that dark chocolate was good for your heart, it didn't take me 21 days to develop that habit.
That's permission based.
That's right, but I mean, a lot of it depends on the habit, and it took me a few weeks. But then I started to say, how do I feel my time? Well, I started going to the gym. I started playing tennis more. I started doing other things. We started going, we started going out. We started hanging out with friends more. And all of a sudden, my life got better. Because I started setting the boundaries that I wanted around my productivity, and my productivity didn't suffer. But what I had to learn to do was to say, I don't need to be in this meeting. I don't need to be, and it sort of starts off with where we ended up today. I mean, sorry, we're back to where we started off today. It's how do you set the boundary around your time, because in a world where everything is coming at you at all, understanding what's truly important and using those values as a way to guide your decision making and tell you where you invest your time has never been more important for a business or for an individual.
Oh, I agree, and that's why I wanted to go back to change, because we started at the top of the hour and meandered off a bit, but change. It is. It's fast. Everything is so fast these days. Honestly, I don't know what happened April, May, June, and July. It's just gone. It came and went. It seemed like the speed of sound. Everything seems to be moving faster, and it goes to what you're talking about. We can access everything quicker. We're doing more and more and more because we have all of the technology. We can drive places. We can be in places where we could not have gotten to even 10 years ago, just very, very quickly. So all that being said, change is not just at the government level or the business level or the solopreneur. It's personal, too. So how do we as people, as individuals who are business people, kind of harness that idea of change? How do we say, okay, everything is moving so quickly. What is important to me, and how do I harness this?
Well, and I think what you're referring to is this feeling that you're out of control.
It's chaotic. I have to say, things seem chaotic recently. And about the last year or so, I'm noticing more and more, and it's not just me. Things just seem to be chaotic is the only thing I can come up with.
And so one of the things that, and I write about this in the book, there's a chapter in the book called When Change Isn't a Choice.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking.
And so there is a piece in there, and what we talk about is that how you feel in an environment, how you feel in a situation, is directly related to how you think.
Well, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, but here's what happens. It's our brain works so quickly that how I think and how I feel sometimes feel like it's all one thing. But the feeling behind it is based upon, how we think about that situation. And so the thing that we have to do from a chaos standpoint is to really control, when change isn't a choice with us, we have to control how we think about it. For example, remember the name Grandma Moses?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the painter.
Right.
Yeah. She didn't really begin painting till very, very late in life.
She's a folk artist, right?
Yeah. So why didn't she? Because the reason she started painting is because arthritis prevented her from doing the needlework that she really loved doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know,
she substituted one activity for another.
Right. And so, but in that case, the key part, though, is how she thought. Because what she could have said is, I can't do this, so I can't do anything.
Oh.
And what she instead said is, I can't do this, so I'll do this. And so, from a chaos standpoint, when you're experiencing chaos, the first choice is how we think. One thought says, it's chaotic, I can't do anything, so I'll throw up my hands. And then when we do that, we end up feeling bad.
I will do that for about a minute and a half, and then, you know, after that minute and a half, I'm going, okay, I'm fine, and I go do something different. But you know,
right.
Every once in a while, I'll get into it just because it's fun, and I get to laugh at myself.
Well,
and then I get back at it.
It can be cathartic. It can be very
cathartic. Yeah, it can. Yeah.
From a chaos standpoint, I mean, there's a priority piece of this from a change, dealing with change. But there's also a standpoint of how we think. Now, here's where we have to rewire part of our expectations. You know, every change really has three parts. It has an ending where things stop being the way they were. There's a new beginning where things are done, and then there's the point in the middle, which we would, you know, William Bridges called it transition. It's basically where things are in flux and chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing that makes today different than other changes is we perpetually live in that state of transition. You know, if you think about it from a historic standpoint, there's a model of change that says basically you take something, you unfreeze a habit, you reformulate it, and then you refreeze it. Then you refreeze it again. Something stops, it changes, and then it stops, starts again. What's going on right now in our lives is that things are moving so quickly, we feel like we're always in that middle. And that middle stands, you know, it's like being in the middle of the interstate on the median where cars are flying by you at 80 miles an hour on both sides, and you're stuck in the middle. You can't go back, and you can't go forward. And
right.
At that point in time, that's that chaos that people feel. And at that point in time, two things have to happen. One is you have to change your thinking. The second thing is you have to realize that you have to slow down a little bit and only focus on those things that are important.
Stop reacting and being reactive and actually settle down a bit and reflect
right.
on what's going on and then make decisions?
You have to reflect and make a conscious choice.
Okay.
I had a college professor that talked about it. He used the word around it. It's called spinating.
I was going to ask you about that because I've seen that word used in conjunction with you. And I want to tell our audience, I've got your book on order. But what you were telling me in my green room before my monitor went is that it will be available pretty quickly on Audible.
Right.
So I've got Audible credits,
and
I'm going to grab that one.
It's an audio. It will come out in an audio book. You know, I recorded it about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago. So however long it takes them to get it out is how long
mm-hmm.
It's when it will come. But the term spinating really refers to what's supposed to happen is this. An impulse hits it travels up our nerves, hits our spinal cord, and goes up through our brain before it comes out as a conscious thought. Spinating.
I didn't know
is
that.
Yeah, I mean that's the way it's supposed to happen. I mean, we get an impulse, right? It goes up,
right.
It hits the spinal cord, you know, it goes up our nerves or whatever that might be. It hopefully processes through our brain, and then it comes out as either action or words or whatever. That's the way it's supposed to happen. Too often, though, what happens is if you picture it this way, you know, the impulse hits us, it travels up our spinal cord, and when it gets to a point parallel to our mouth, for example, it shoots out our mouth without going through our brain. And we've all experienced
that. That's what my
that.
Mother called no filters.
Right. And
I have none.
And so, you know, what happens, though, is when we allow ourselves to get in, and it's basically a stimulus response loop, okay? So stimulus response, and there's no filter around that. What we have to do as humans, and this is part of what makes, going back to the dodo and coyote perspective, mm-hmm. this is what the dodo never had the ability to break that response loop.
So he never thought to go take his eggs and hide them.
Right, because he didn't have the capacity to do that.
Right.
And so from the standpoint of a human, we have to stop and think, okay, this is my world. What do I do differently? We have to break that stimulus response loop. And that, you know, by the way, companies do that as well. Things are slow. Okay, well, we have to lay people off. It's a stimulus response. Now, sometimes you have to lay people off. Sometimes what you need to do is take those people and refocus them doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
But when we fall into that destructive loop where we're not making conscious choices and slowing down a little bit, then it's very difficult for us to deal with that chaotic change.
Well, and going back to change, Randy, I'm looking at your editorial reviews on Amazon, and one of the things that is in there says why change fails and what good change looks like in today's organizations, and that kind of leads into what you were just talking about. So rather than fail, can people just kind of go in and do what you just said and say, okay, we don't want to close the company, we don't want to lay people off, but here's what needs to happen. You, Thelma, are very, very good at things that you're not currently doing. We need to shift you over here. And instantly, while I'm saying this, I can feel resistance from Thelma. Am I wrong?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
No.
I'm wrong or right? Because
no,
I can see Thelma going, that's not what I'm used to. That's not what I got hired for.
That's not what I'm used to. You're exactly right. So here's
right.
a couple of principles. Right. First off, one is that instead of saying, Thelma, this is what you're good at, and I want you to do this, I mean, that may work in a crisis. Because the building's burning down and Thelma's really good at opening the door. Somebody's got to open the door and she gets that, right? So,
right.
A general principle of engaging others is this. People support what they help create.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
Good point.
And so, you know, if I have a company and I'm going to have to let, you can say, we have a company, here's where we are, this is what our situation is. Here's what we need to accomplish to get this done. What could you do even outside of what you normally do to help us do this? How do you help contribute?
Suppose you've identified that Thelma is really, really good at social media or public relations or something to do with people, but she's actually been working in a back office doing, let's say, accounting. How do you lead her gently to maybe a brand new role that's going to scare the bejeebers out of her?
Well, what you say is, Thelma, you seem very good at this. Do you have an interest?
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, this is something you seem you have an interest, and we're going to get you help. We're going to provide you some coaching. We're going to give you some support. We're not expecting you to come in and. She goes, this is going to scare me to death. And you go, you're right, mm-hmm. It is going to scare you to death. But you're not going to have to go through this by yourself.
Okay.
See, I mean, it's sort of like when the person that your television provider, whether it's cable or dish or whatever, is teaching you how to program your DVR. You know, if they left you alone to say, okay, now here's how here's the thing, program your DVR, it'd probably scare you mm-hmm. to death. But when they're walking you through it and they're right there and they're being very supportive in at the time you're doing that, and they're saying, okay, that's you could let me see if I can show you a different way of doing it. And
okay.
you basically have to help people. You have to help people through it. And, again, if it's her idea, that's great. If she can have input, at whatever level she can have input into that decision and how it's done, that builds ownership for it. And mm-hmm. you have to realize then as people are learning, they're going to make some mistakes. And so from a leadership standpoint, then you have to understand that the only person who never makes a mistake is the person who's never trying anything new.
That is so true. And here's what I have observed, even in myself. Sometimes I will not make a decision, and I don't think I'm alone in this. I will not make a decision because I know good and well I can do it perfectly, and I really don't want to hand off to somebody else, because then, and this is always my argument with myself, look, I could have already done it. It would have been done properly. The formatting is done properly. The graphics are beautiful. Whatever my excuses were, and they are excuses. Or I can go ahead and make some kind of a workplace manual, which I've learned to do, hand it off to somebody, but then my other excuse is, oh, but then I have to go check it, and I don't have time. I mean, there's always this round robin of reasons why you can't hand things off. And honestly, Randy, I think that's what slows all of us down. If we don't bring people into the fold and trust them to do what they're supposed to do, I mean, yeah, check on them, but you know, unless you kind of give up that control, you're going to be standing still, don't you think?
Absolutely. And giving up control is scary. You can do it through training.
Yeah.
You can do it through training. You can do it through having clear processes. You can do it by setting very clear boundaries. If it's anywhere in here within the boundaries, you know, I trust you when it goes out of these boundaries. And the other part of it is this. The boundaries change. Boundaries change based upon experience, based upon knowledge, based upon proven worth. I tend to look at work as a lot like life, is that, you know, if your 10-year-old daughter came into you today and said, you know, Mom, Dad, I want to go on a date with a 17-year-old boy, and we're going to a concert in his new van.
No.
Nobody's going to do that, you know, right? You know, at the same time.
No.
Yeah, nobody's going to do that. And by the way, please don't write in and say that he was doing okay until he said okay for 10-year-olds to date. That's not what I'm saying. But, you know, at the same time, if she came in and said, hey, Mom, Dad, my best friend from class who lives three doors down in the neighborhood would like to know if I can come over to play, depending upon the neighborhood and you checking things out, you might allow her to walk the three doors down, depending on the neighborhood and the situation, on her own.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in other words, so the boundaries change based upon experience, based upon the situation, based upon the environment, based upon the training level, based upon past performance, all those things. So you can minimize those feelings, but again, anytime you let somebody go for the first time, it's going to be scary.
Right.
And I liken it to the first night your teenage son or daughter drove on their own after getting their driver's license.
Yeah.
You've done everything in the world that you know how to do, but sooner or later you have to suck it up and say, I got to let
go
them go.
Forth.
Because, yeah,
yeah.
You've got to go forth. And from a business standpoint, again, if you go back to your example, when you find yourself saying, yeah, it's easier for me to do it than them doing it, and said, okay, if you were paying $95 an hour for that, would it be a good decision?
And I have that talk with myself a lot. I really do. And
because
I have to actually stop and say, okay, should you be doing this, Denise? And half the time the answer is no. Why are you keep asking me this? I'm training myself.
Supposedly, only you can be. You're the only person that can do that $95 an hour work. There's a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more people that can do the $15 an hour work, and that's really what, from a leadership and a business standpoint, to keep the organization moving. If you're in business today, trust me, your employees can tell you 25 ways that things can get better, that they can do things better, faster, cheaper, or friendlier. They can tell you that right now,
mm-hmm.
and they can implement that change, and they're dying to. They're just waiting for you to lead them through it.
And you know, and that leads me to another question, and we're just about out of time. I would love for you to come back another time if you would.
I would love to continue the conversation. It's fun.
Yeah, this hour just flew by, monitor problems and all. And by the way, you know what it was? I unplugged it.
That's
simple.
That's how
the cord that went into the back of it wasn't real stable, and when I reached underneath it, it just completely discharged, you know, just took it apart, and I went, oh, great. But anyway, you know, lesson learned. Now it's in there real tight. But I do want you to come back, so I would love for you to. But here's my other question, and I think I read this in one of the blurbs on your book, is that your book and you say, listen, there are so many different ways that you can be nimble and that you can respond to what's going on with your customer base or your client base. Number one is through your employees. Number two is through your customers.
Right.
Is that, I believe I read that.
Yes, and you have to listen. I mean, your customers will tell you where they want you to go.
Right.
Or let's put it this way, your good customers will tell you where they want you to go. Because just because a customer tells you that doesn't necessarily make it the right thing. I want to know, you know, does my ideal customer think this is where I ought to go? Because, quite frankly, most businesses have customers that they would be probably ought to get rid of.
Oh, I agree.
The answer is listen to those customers that are the kind of customers with the kinds of margins, with the kinds of service levels, with the kinds of respect and open communication that you want. Listen to those folks. Go there because they'll tell you where you need to go with your business.
And I think that's absolutely true. I mean, if you're not polling your customers, your good customers, then you're always going to have that one that comes in or calls or emails and makes a lot of noise. And you're right. You have to really determine what that customer's worth is to you. Are they just, you know, kind of a complainer, or do they really have a valid point? But, yeah, that's part of being nimble, I think. But very quickly, and we're no longer recording, but, I mean, we're no longer streaming. We're still recording. And I want to go back to Change because I'm dying to hear that book. I'm going to wait till it's out on Audible. I love to work and listen while I'm working. What types of changes should people expect to deal with in the future as far as business goes and just kind of how they manage everything?
Well, a couple of things that you can count on. Technology is going to continue to have an influence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be the I read something the other day, and I think it kind of goes along with this idea of technology, that the smartphone may be obsolete by the year 2030.
I saw that, but I didn't read it. Can you tell me what that was all about?
Yeah, and the idea is that computing is going to become much more mobile and probably wearable.
Like the Google Glass.
Like Google Glass, like things in your clothes, like things in your ear, like things in your... So, you know, assume that technology is going to be more mobile, whatever that looks like. I mean, I think that's a good trend. I think you're going to see the workforce get older and younger simultaneously.
Oh, we've got to talk about that on the next show.
Yeah, but and older
I
because
I think I understand what you're talking about, but I would love to hear more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you 30 seconds and then we'll
okay.
or 10 seconds on it and then we'll talk about it on the next show. But one is it's demographics. The baby boomers are not going to retire. They're not going to go quietly.
No.
It's not in their nature to do that, and most of them aren't financially able to do that. So you're going to see people continuing to work much longer. Likewise, though, we have an entire new generation. The millennials that are just coming into the workplace are changing. They will change the way we work. I think, as a rule, they're an extremely positive generation, and they bring a lot of great skills to the table, and there's a whole bunch of them. They rival the baby boomers in size. So I think, again, you're going to see more younger people coming in and older people staying on. Third thing that you can count on, I think, from a change that's going to happen perspective, is the economy has changed the economic meltdown of 2008 and subsequent lag time and coming back up has changed the discussion for a generation, at least, or for most of a generation, about how they view money.
Which generation?
Well, I mean, I think it's changed everything, but it certainly changes the new generation coming in who's seen their parents go without jobs and what have you. I mean,
gotcha.
I don't think we're going to go back. If you assume normal is the way things were in 2007, where people were spending money very freely and what, that's not going to happen anytime soon. You know, even though if you look specifically at this last week, two things happened. One is the first time claims for unemployment dropped to the lowest they've been since 2007. And
is that a true measure, though? Because a lot of people are just, you know, going
full
solopreneur, or they are working under the table. I don't believe they're not working.
Yeah, but it's the only measure we have. So it may not be the best measure, but it's the only. It may not be a great measure, but it's the only one we have.
So it's an indicator, nothing more.
Yeah, it's an indicator. And at the same time, Walmart just saw that there was a 3% drop in same-store sales. So theoretically, you have more people working and fewer people spending money.
Right. I know Macy's, and they're, you know, opposite ends of the spectrum, but they had the same thing. And I read something yesterday where that, you know, Macy's and Walmart losing sales is probably more indicative of what's really going on than anything else.
And so really what you're having is not that people are necessarily making – it's not just that they're not working, although I think most – there's a huge underemployment problem in the economy right now that we can talk about the next time. But it's just that the people aren't spending money. Again, part of it's an uncertainty standpoint. Part of it is a fear standpoint. They have changed the way – you know, my parents were both Depression-era people, and – you know, they saved money religiously because it was, they didn't ever want to be without money if there was another depression.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my father died with more money than he would ever need in the bank that he wouldn't spend because he was afraid, you know, in the next week the world could all change. And it's something that's changed him from his, that changed his entire life.
My grandparents came from that mindset. And it was, I thought at the time, you know, when they passed away, that they had lived a very odd lifestyle. They had plenty of money, plenty of cash. But they, if we would give them a gift, my grandmother in particular, we would give her, you know, maybe a really nice nightgown set or something for Christmas. And Randy, we found them in boxes, in tissue, in mothballs at the top of her closet when she passed away because she was saving them for good. She was saving them for later. You know, everything was saved. And I remember thinking, oh, my gosh. Well, let me tell you, I'm about there with her now because I'm thinking, okay, now I get it. Now I understand why they saved everything and you know, they didn't buy a bunch of junk at the dollar store that they really didn't need. They were very, and I'm not going to say parsimonious, but they were very cautious with their money, and that's a good thing.
Well, and you know, when I found, you know, when my mother moved out of her house and my brother and I came to help clear out the house, and she moved into an assisted living facility, when that happened, we cleaned out, and one of the things that we found in the attic was a bag of potting soil.
Oh.
Because
how interesting.
there were plants that she had that somebody had given her and the plant had died and she said, you know, I might need potting soil.
Oh.
And so she's put it in a garbage bag and stuck it in the attic.
I'm telling you, I'm revisiting my grandmother's house right now in my mind.
And so I look at it and say, okay, when you're conservative enough that you think I might need a bag of potting soil, I might need dirt, then that tells you. I mean, so I don't know that we're 100% there yet, but I do think from a change standpoint, that means for a business we're going to have to figure out different ways to add value to customers other than just sell them more.
Exactly. And the customer experience to me is something that's almost, well, often as important as whatever it is that I'm purchasing it. You know, there. I mean, I have been known to walk into a store and if I see the little checker behind the counter, she's popping her gum and she's on her cell phone, I turn around, I march my butt right back out.
So, I mean, I do think that
there's
too
much competition.
And so that means with that in mind, I think that businesses are going to have to figure out, you know, we're going to have to be better because people have too many choices. and they're going to be much more frugal with their money. So they're going to make better choices. Now, as soon as I say that, and it sounds negative, I also believe 100% that in 50 years we will look back at this time and the great businesses and the great brands of our country 50 years from now were probably born out of what's going on today.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at history at all, and I love history, I think if you don't understand history, you're in trouble. But if you look at what happened in the early days of America with the Rockefellers and the railroads and, you know, all of the iron barons and the steel barons and the railroad barons, that money's still around in large part. I mean, those companies came to being out of sheer necessity. There was a need, and they fulfilled those needs. And I think you're right. I think that the same thing is, I mean, it's always happened. But I think at this point in time, it's going to be another one of those golden age type of things down the road. Not now, but down the road, we're going to realize that some golden ages, the golden age came from this time. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, if you look at the great brands, many of the great companies today, actually began during the Great Depression of the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. We are way out of time, and I have so enjoyed talking with you. We're about 10 minutes over, and I definitely, definitely want you to come back, talk more about the book, and talk more about the change. But thank you so much for being here, and thank you for introducing yourself when I had my little monitor meltdown.
My pleasure, and if folks are still listening right now, they can obviously find the book at Amazon or any place else that sells books, and I hope they enjoy it and pick it up.
And tell the name of the book again?
The book is called Make Change Work.
Right, and I will get it on, well, I'm going to take it out of my Amazon wish list. I'm going to put it in Audible. But you know, this is silly. What I often will do is I'll get it in hardback because I love to pick up an actual book and feel it and crack the spine and smell it. And then I'll get it on my Kindle. And then if it's available on Audible, so half the time with these books, you know, I've got them three ways, you know, because I never know how I want to learn that day.
Well, and the good news is that this book's going to be available very soon on all three. So it is
all three, great.
It's in hardback and Kindle right now, and it will be in an audio book soon.
Great. Randy, thank you so much for being here
thank
today.
Thank you. I look forward to talking to you again.
Definitely. Well, listen, everybody, thank you for being here. The show will be available for download in about an hour. You can also find us in iTunes. Just type in our names. And this is Denise Griffiths and Randy Pennington wishing you a wonderful weekend, and I will see you next week. Thank you, Randy.
Thank you.
You can find Denise Griffiths at your office on theweb.com or at gottagovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on your Partner in Success Radio.